I'm Carol Hills. Today on The World...
Okay, women and children first. Try to keep the children as dry as you possibly can.
Sara Mardini was trying to make her way to Greece with other Syrian refugees. Her boat started to sink, so she jumped into the sea and swam for hours, towing the boat behind her.
It was a sea that was very rough. So while you're holding the boat, there was a lot of wind and water that comes and make your face hit with a dinghy.
She was hailed as a hero, but now she's caught in another nightmare. Plus, a soccer player posts a chilling message on Facebook after being detained.
If I am deported to Bahrain, don't forget me. And if once I'm there, you hear me saying things, don't believe me.
And your wedding might have been epic, but did you have Hillary Clinton busting a move with Bollywood stars? Didn't think so. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for tuning in. It's no fun to be stuck in the middle, and boy, is Canada caught in between the U.S. and China right now. Chinese authorities have confirmed that they've detained two Canadian citizens. Both are reportedly being investigated for activities that endanger China's national security. Except pretty much everyone else sees this as retaliation for Canada arresting a top Chinese business executive earlier this month, an arrest requested by the U.S. in the middle of a trade war between Washington and Beijing. Emily Rahala is Canada reporter for The Washington Post and was previously based in Beijing.
So far, there are two Canadians who are missing and presumed detained in China. The first one, Michael Kovrig, is a former Canadian diplomat who has been working for the last year or so for the International Crisis Group, which is a think tank. And the second is Michael Spavor. He's a North Korea guy who runs tours to North Korea. He helped coordinate Dennis Rodman's trip. And as far as I know, he's based in Beijing.
So is there any broken line that links these two people, these two Canadians, anything at all?
The first thing to note is that we don't know yet. They are missing and they're presumed detained. The Chinese side has confirmed that they have them, but they've not formally said why they have them, what they did wrong. They presented fairly vague charges in the International Crisis Group case, something related to operating in China under China's NGO law. In the second case, something related to endangering Chinese national security. The truth is these laws are pretty vague and they can mean a whole lot of different things. And we're probably going to have to wait to see how this plays out to know exactly what the Chinese authorities are going for here.
And of course, this comes 1 week after Canada arrested a Chinese executive. She's a Chinese businesswoman. Do we know why she was picked up?
Yes, that's right. Her name is Meng Wanzhou, and she's the chief financial officer for Huawei Technologies, which is China's largest privately held firm and one of the biggest telecoms in the world. She was picked up in Vancouver on U.S. charges and now faces possible extradition to the U.S. We don't know a whole lot about that case yet. The case is still sealed, but we know that she's wanted on a case related to fraud and Iran sanctions violations. And just days after she was picked up in Canada, China warned of severe consequences. And then just days after that, again, we had the disappearance and a presumed detention of these two Canadian men.
Do you hear anything in Canada that people there feel like they're being squeezed and possibly used in a spat, which is really between Beijing and Washington?
Definitely. There's a strong sense in Canada that, we're sort of in an awkward position of having to do U.S. bidding after a year in particular where relationships with the U.S. have been at an all-time low. And now after, having Donald Trump insult the Canadian prime minister, we're in the position of taking a lot of heat from China over what is essentially a U.S. case.
Canada experienced a similar tiff with China several years ago, and it concerned the case of Kevin and Julia Garrett. Tell us about them.
That's right. This was in 2014. What happened is we had a somewhat similar timeline that now, with hindsight, looks quite suspicious. A Chinese national named Su Bin was arrested in Canada and was awaiting extradition to the United States, very much like the case now with Meng Wanzhou of Huawei. After Canada was in the extradition proceedings to hand him over to the Americans, I think it was a matter of weeks later, China picked up two Canadians who were working near the North Korea border in China. They're Christian missionaries, I believe, and charged them with very similar sort of vaguely spy-related charges. And they ended up spending a long time in detention, really going through a horrible and very lengthy ordeal. China never directly tied those two cases. But I think, again, most long-term China watchers see a pretty clear pattern here of China responding to legal moves against its citizens with retaliatory arrests.
Emily Rahala of The Washington Post, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
So what's it like to be picked up by the secret police in China? The Garretts that Emily just mentioned, Kevin and Julia, were interviewed via Skype last night on Canada's Global News TV. Kevin Garrett said it was a horrifying experience.
It was totally unexpected. And I was fearful when, 18 or so security people grab you and take you back to the Ministry of State Security station. And then there's a bunch of them, probably 8 or 10 of them around you trying to get you to sign this paper saying I agree to be investigated. It's pretty intimidating when there's a camera pointing at you and they're not pleasant voices they're using.
Yeah, I had no understanding of what was going on, so I didn't see any badges or anything like that. I just was grabbed and thrown in a car, and then basically after this quick turnaround in the station, I was just driven off into the darkness because it's not done in a formal arrest style, and it's actually not a legal arrest in China's criminal system. It's just you disappear and you're interrogated. Yeah, I was shocked. And I thought they made a mistake. I kept saying, you made a mistake. You have the wrong people. We were completely taken, blindsided, and so you're terrified. Your body starts to go into shock, and your mind is just thinking about your children and your family and wondering, they're not going to know where I am. Yeah, it was pretty psychologically very, very traumatic for us.
But that was just the beginning. The Garretts were initially held in isolation for months with no clear idea why.
We're separated the whole time, 24-7. Lights are on 24-7. There's nothing in your room. If you want a drink of water, you have to ask for it. They have to go get it. You want to brush your teeth, they have to go get your toothbrush for you. So you have nothing of your own in the room.
And then you have 6 hours of interrogation every day with three people. So I had three men interrogating me for 6 hours a day. And that happened in the daytime for the most part, 7 days a week, continually. And you never know what they're going to ask. And so you're just trying to deal with that. And then they give you homework at night. So you have to go home and go home. You have to stay in your room and do this sort of homework for them, which is writing all sorts of confession type papers. So it's really complicated.
The couple's ordeal would go on for 2 years. Last night, they offered this advice to Michael Kovrig, one of the Canadians being held by China now.
It'll be hard, but he can make it through. He really can. And, for us, it's faith. It's faith in God. That's what we held on to because, especially for myself, I knew nothing for those 2 years when it might end.
And I would say just put a timetable in your day and just do things that use up the hours because the hours go in seconds. And so find strategies, sing and try to recall every good memory and limit over and over and just create a world within a box for yourself that has beautiful things inside it and things that you enjoy and things that will keep you healthy.
Julia and Kevin Garrett speaking last night via Skype with Canada's Global News. Now to Thailand, where a professional athlete from Bahrain was detained recently, and he's facing extradition back to Bahrain, even though his home for the past 4 years has been Australia.
I didn't do anything in Bahrain. I'm a refugee in Australia. I brought citizenship soon in Australia. I'm Australian, not Bahrain.
That's Hakim Al-Rahibi, desperately trying to tell his side of the story while in handcuffs ahead of a hearing in a Thai court. At the end there, he's saying, I'm Australian, not Bahraini. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following this story in Bangkok. Patrick, let's rewind for a minute. Who is Hakim Al-Rahibi?
Hakim used to be a national soccer player in Bahrain. Supposedly he was quite good. But then his fate turned after the Arab Spring. So you remember back in 2011, lots of countries in that part of the world were seeing uprisings. Well, the same thing happened in Bahrain. During that, he was critical of the monarchy that runs Bahrain. He fell afoul of them. He was tortured, and he started looking for a way out. And then, about 5 years ago, ended up in Australia where he got refugee status. So his life has been going, pretty well in Australia. He's playing for a football club there. Until recently, he went on a honeymoon in Thailand.
So he and his wife decide to take a vacation or honeymoon, and that's in November. So they arrive in Bangkok, and he is promptly detained. How did that happen?
Well, it turned out, unbeknownst to him, that his home country of Bahrain was looking for him. They wanted him back, and they had an Interpol warning out for him. So, you know, presumably some agent at the airport in Thailand sees his name, sees something pop up, and then they detain him, and that sort of starts his nightmare. Now, this gets tricky because for Thailand, now they have a choice. Do they send him back to Bahrain, where he is wanted, where he says he will be tortured if he's returned to that country? Do they send him back to Australia, where he has refugee status? So he's now caught in this sort of geopolitical tug of war.
Now, you mentioned this Interpol warning. What is that? Are you saying that Bahrain tells Interpol, we want this guy, put a notice out for him? How does that work?
Yeah, well, you know, Carol, if you rob a bank and then go overseas to France, France is supposed to say, hey, we have Carol, she robbed that bank. Now, you're not supposed to use it if you're a political refugee, but Bahrain says that he vandalized a police station in 2012, and that's why they want him, and that's a crime. The guy has a great alibi. He was supposedly playing a soccer game on television when he supposedly attacked this police station, so that seems unlikely. Anyway, they're using the law against him. They know they can't just come out and say, we want him because he's a dissident. They have to say that he committed a crime.
How about Thailand? Could Thailand face any diplomatic fallout from sending him back?
I think so. I mean, all the major rights groups are saying don't do this. Obviously, the Australian government is saying don't do this. But in the past few years, past 10 years, Thailand has shown this disposition towards sending dissidents back to the countries that request them. We've seen this with China. They sent back Uyghur dissidents. We've seen this with Laos. They've sent back Hmong dissidents. So Thailand is not a good place to go and hide out if you are wanted by your home country and if your home country is authoritarian.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you, Carol.
When I hear the words advent calendar, what leaps to mind are the ones I grew up with. A piece of chocolate behind a little door, one for each day of the Christmas season. In Germany, a far-right political party has attracted some attention and mockery for a different sort of advent calendar. Here's the World's Matthew Bell.
The Berlin branch of the AfD, or Alternative for Germany, put out the online calendar, and of course it came with a hashtag, Sag ja zu weißen Männern, meaning say yes to white men.
Mein Name ist Dr. Dieter Neuendorf, kulturpolitischer Sprecher der AfD-Fraktion.
In the run-up to Christmas, members of the AfD are appearing in social media videos like this one, each day highlighting the achievements of a white man. The idea is to, quote, oppose the demonization of white men that has become fashionable and point out their numerous merits. The white man of the day today is the Berlin architect Friedrich Schinkel. Other white males chosen for the calendar, Ronald Reagan, Albert Einstein, Bertolt Brecht, Pope John Paul II, and the first chancellor of the German Empire, Otto von Bismarck. Unsurprisingly, the campaign has faced a mixture of outrage and ridicule. Critics are suggesting their own additions to the list of white men, Harvey Weinstein, prominent Nazis, and even Harry Potter's arch nemesis, Voldemort. The AfD may be a joke to many people, but the party has been rising fast since it was founded in 2013. In last year's national elections, it became the third largest party in Germany, fueled by its anti-immigrant message. Its members have used racist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic language. They have been linked with neo-Nazis and other far-right groups. But the party describes itself as a nationalist movement, sticking up for average Germans. Judging by the advent calendar, that would be average white Germans, even though one of the so-called white men championed in the calendar is none other than Apple founder Steve Jobs, the American son of a Syrian immigrant. For the World, I'm Matthew Bell.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. What were you wearing? That's an all-too-common question women hear after they report being sexually assaulted. It's also the question at the heart of an exhibit right now in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Hundreds of people are going there each day to see it. We're going to hear what makes this exhibit so powerful, and I want to warn you, this is a very sensitive subject. On display are articles of clothing worn by women at the time they were raped. Next to them, the stories about what happened in each case. The exhibit was done in collaboration with the Swedish Embassy, UN UN Women and a feminist organization in Ethiopia called Setawit. Nardos Mella is the curator and a member of Setawit. Nardos, how did the What She Wore exhibit come together?
There's a huge number of victim blaming here. It's a question of they start off in a defensive way. You know, it's not like, oh, yeah, she's hurt, she's a victim. It's more like, what did you do to initiate it? Like, where were you? What were you doing? What were you wearing? You know, it's usually something like that. People don't actually listen to the victims. They don't actually pay attention to what they're saying. And this was a way of proving to everyone, you know, the stories and the clothes, and you can actually see it because the stories are too horrible to even make up.
What are some of these women's stories?
Our youngest survivor is 7 years old, who got raped by her father. Then there is the story about a girl who got raped by the police when she was looking for shelter. This girl who got raped by her father and got pregnant twice. You know, these are some of their stories. We had 16 stories in total.
In any of the cases that you are representing at this exhibit, did any of them result in any kind of conviction?
Yes. Yes, they did. Only two of the abusers didn't get charged. So all the survivors, they're in shelters now. Some of them are still undergoing trial. We found them in the shelters. We actually had to go to the shelters to actually get their consent and to get the clothes and share their stories with us.
Ethiopia is doing a lot to bring awareness to women's issues. Give us a sense of the things going on.
The focus is, since our new PM, he's actually giving a lot of attention to women empowerment, that we have the female president and everything. But, you know, when it actually comes down to the groundwork, the work that actually needs to be done regarding women, there's still a lot to be done. And this exhibit kind of shed light into how much we have to work on. We had people actually coming and telling us their story, sharing what happened to them anonymously. This is an actual very, very serious issue.
Nardos, it sounds like the exhibit is really having an impact. But what still really needs to change in Ethiopia? I mean, how widespread are antiquated attitudes about sexual violence toward women?
We're actually trying to get petitions. We're getting petitions signed about a project we have called Altu Lemon Motech. And it means, why did Altu die? Altu was a girl. She was a domestic worker. She was raped, and she was raped by her employer and then attacked by acid below the waist. And she came to the hospital, but unfortunately, she didn't make it. And, you know, acid attacks are becoming a thing here. We wanted to put restrictions on the sellers, not the buyers. You know, like maybe it could be a permit or just some way of restricting it. And the second thing would be the doctors, you know, when there are actual acid victims, when they go to the hospital, they don't get the right kind of treatment. So we're trying to push for someone who's actually qualified enough to treat them. And the third thing we were pushing for was that we need to, the punishment for this attacks is not enough. It's just, it's seen as a bodily harm, and the maximum amount of punishment they keep getting is not enough. It's not even close to being enough.
We've been speaking to Nardos Mellis. She is the curator of an exhibit in Addis Ababa, which is showing the articles of clothing worn by women at the time they were raped. Thank you very much, Nardos.
And thank you very much for having me.
Last July, Efrain De La Rosa died in an immigrant detention facility in Lumpkin, Georgia, where he was being held. We know that De La Rosa was a 40-year-old Mexican immigrant, and we also know that he was the third person to die at the Stewart Detention Center, a for-profit immigrant holding facility, in the last 19 months. But if you want to know the results of Georgia's investigation into De La Rosa's death, well, you can't. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation is refusing to share that information. Robin Yurovich looked into this. She's a reporter for the online publication Capital and Maine. Robin, what do you know or suspect about how De La Rosa died?
Well, what we know from news reports is that Efrain De La Rosa suffered from mental health issues, from schizophrenia, and he was in solitary confinement at Stewart for 21 days, according to a report by The Intercept. The circumstances of De La Rosa's death were very similar to those of another man who died at Stewart in 2017, Giancarlo Jimenez Joseph.
And tell us about him.
He suffered from mental health issues. He was locked in solitary confinement for about 2 weeks. He repeatedly asked for help with his mental health issues, never received it, and was found dead in his cell.
But in that case, you were able to investigate. This time around with De La Rosa, you've been stymied, haven't you?
Yes. This time around, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation has refused to release the results of its investigation.
Why is that?
Well, the person I spoke to at the GBI said that they were warned by CoreCivic, the for-profit detention company that runs Stewart for ICE, that they could not release the results of the investigation based on a federal regulation.
Was the state of Georgia able to be more specific about this federal rule?
Yes, there is a federal regulation, and it does prohibit states and localities from releasing information about immigration detainees. But I mean, one attorney that I spoke to said that this rule has its underpinnings in the Privacy Act, and the Privacy Act no longer applies to people who are deceased.
Is De La Rosa's family concerned about the situation?
Oh, yes. He has a brother who's a longtime resident in the United States, and he has family in Mexico. They're looking into it. The Mexican consulate requested information. They received only a medical report, which referred, according to the consul, to a lot of other documents that they were not provided. They, in early November, requested additional documents, and as of early December, had not heard anything.
Is there concern that this sets a precedent, that no detention center will release information after a death, an unexplained death, in future cases?
I think it is a concern, especially regarding the Stewart Detention Center. ICE and the Department of Homeland Security generally hold information very close. And in the case of Stewart, when it has been released, the same problems have been revealed over and over again. The problems that were uncovered in the Georgia Bureau of Investigation probe last year revealed insufficient medical and mental health care. Those are the same problems that were discovered by the Department of Homeland Security's own Office of Inspector General more than a year before. I visited Stewart last spring and found that some of those same issues were reported by detainees and even by a former Stewart employee. So when the information isn't released, it seems like it's even more concerning.
Robin Yurovich is a reporter for the online publication Capital in Maine. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills. In El Salvador, the ban on abortion is so strict that even having a miscarriage could land you in jail.
When they walk across the yard, people shout at them, "Te comiste a tus hijos," you ate your children.
The women marked as criminals and the activists working to change it. That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's crunch time at the Global Climate Conference in Katowice, Poland. Countries are supposed to be figuring out a way to put some muscle into the promises of the 2015 Paris Agreement. But the talks have bogged down even as the climate crisis gets worse. And many fingers are being pointed at the U.S. Here's Rachel Waldholtz with our story.
In the hallways and conference rooms here in Katowice, among sleep-deprived delegates and activists, there's a palpable worry. The deadline for this year's climate summit is tomorrow, and negotiators still haven't resolved many of the most important issues. So there's a real concern here that the summit will fail to deliver, both on what was promised in Paris 3 years ago and what most here say is needed now, as the dangerous realities of climate change become more clear. It's a concern that's shared at the highest levels.
To waste this opportunity in Katowice would compromise our last best chance to stop runaway climate change.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who told the countries gathered here to basically step up. To fail here, Guterres said,
it would not only be immoral, it would be suicidal.
The negotiators here have a heavy lift. 3 years ago, in Paris, nearly every country on Earth agreed to slash carbon pollution with the goal of limiting global warming to no more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. That's about 1 degree beyond where we already are. But they left the details of how to do that to be worked out later. That's what this meeting is supposed to deliver. In the meantime, the stakes have only gotten higher. Scientists say there are clear signs that climate change is already making storms, floods, fires, and droughts worse. And a new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, concluded that warming must be limited to 1.5 degrees Celsius to avoid horror movie scenarios, like rapid sea level rise. That means the world must not only meet its Paris commitments, but also raise those commitments significantly. So far, negotiators are bogged down. And one wild card in the discussions is the U.S. President Trump has promised to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement as soon as he can, in November 2020. But until then, the U.S. is still at the negotiating table, even as Trump administration officials criticize the entire process.
The president has made it clear that under his leadership, the United States will not subject its citizens to agreements that hamstring our economic growth, prosperity, or national security.
That's White House Energy Advisor Wells Griffiths speaking earlier this week. He and others have also made it clear that the U.S. is opposed to any limits on the use of fossil fuels. Griffith hosted the only official U.S. event at the conference, which was devoted to innovations in coal, gas, and nuclear power, and played down the threat of climate change.
Alarmism should not silence realism.
Many countries here think it's the U.S. refusing to recognize reality. American negotiators antagonized many countries when they joined forces with Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait to block acceptance of that report detailing the importance of holding warming to 1.5 degrees. The Trump administration has also refused to pay what the U.S. has already promised into a fund to help poorer nations respond to the climate crisis. That has infuriated developing countries, who say that as the largest historical emitter, the U.S. bears much of the responsibility for creating the problem. And it's all left some countries fed up. On Tuesday, Ralph Reagan Vanu, the foreign minister of the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu, said publicly what many people here are saying privately, that the U.S. is blocking progress. And he said that negotiators from the U.S. and other rich countries will be condemned by history.
Whether you welcome or note or shamelessly ignore the signs altogether, the fact remains that this is catastrophic for humanity. And party negotiators blocking meaningful progress should have much on their conscience.
It's impossible to say yet what the U.S.'s mark will be on the final outcome here. But observers say that perhaps even more important than what the U.S. is doing is what it's not doing, that is, not providing leadership.
I don't think there's really any substitute for the U.S. when it comes to its ability to kind of pull the world together.
Sue Biniaz was a State Department climate lawyer for decades and helped draft the Paris Agreement. She says that deal was only possible because the U.S. and China, the world's two largest emitters, worked together ahead of time. And then the U.S. put its full force into an agreement in Paris. She says there's no similar leadership this time around, especially with major European players like France, Germany, and the UK, distracted by politics at home. There are even fears here that other countries, like Brazil under its new leadership, could follow the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement or drag down negotiations. But behind all the focus on the public statements and actions of the U.S., many here say that things behind the scenes are somewhat different.
My perception would be that the U.S. delegation is conducting itself in a workmanlike way. So in that regard, I think the U.S. is just, it's kind of like business as usual.
Sue Biniaz says many of the negotiators are actually the same career officials who worked on the Paris deal under the Obama administration. And in many cases, they're pursuing the same goals, including one global standard for reporting and tracking emissions. Observers say the U.S. is forging a deal that it could return to someday if a future president chooses to. Still, for many delegates here, anything short of a breakthrough is unacceptable.
We are not prepared to die. We are not going to become the first victims of the climate crisis.
Mohamed Nasheed is the former president of the Maldives, an island nation in the Indian Ocean. Nasheed was a star of the ill-fated Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009. The Paris Agreement raised hopes, but he says not much has really changed.
Carbon emission keeps rising and rising and rising, and all we seem to be doing is talking and talking and talking.
Still, Nasheed says it's still not too late to avoid catastrophic warming.
We can still do it. Every country at this summit will have hell to pay if we don't.
Delegates have one more day to get it done or not. For The World, Rachel Waldholz, Katowice, Poland.
El Salvador is one of just a handful of countries where abortion is banned in all circumstances. And that ban is so draconian that every miscarriage is considered suspicious. Right now, more than a dozen Salvadoran women who say they suffered a miscarriage are serving lengthy jail terms. 25 others have been released after activists intervened on their behalf, citing a lack of evidence that they'd sought abortions. Author Michelle Oberman met two of the women who've been freed. Oberman told my colleague Marco Werman what it was like to watch the two former inmates reunite in Santa Ana, El Salvador.
It took us around 3 hours to get there because the village is at the top of a long, unpaved, really rutted road. It's beautiful, it's green, it's sort of rainforesty, there's bugs and birds everywhere. It's also an area of the country where the gangs are completely in control, so we couldn't leave the car with the driver. And if we brought the driver with us, then the car probably wouldn't have been there when we came back. So we kind of plowed up the road until we saw Mayra walking down toward us. And then Teodora, who hadn't seen her since they'd left prison earlier that spring, jumped out of the car and raced to her. And it was pretty beautiful.
Oh, perritos!
Wow. So how did they get to know each other?
They met in the fourth grade classroom in Ilopango, the women's prison there. Although both had attended school through third grade in rural El Salvador, and school typically meets 2 hours a day, there are no books and classrooms until the third grade. So when both of them arrived in prison, they didn't know how to read.
What they didn't know for years is that they were both in prison for the same charge. Here's Teodora explaining that.
We have both been in prison, her 15 years and myself 10 years and 7 months. And we were in that place in spite of not being delinquents. We did not do the acts we were accused of. We were in there for obstetrical emergencies that neither she nor I had planned. That's a similarity. Facing 30-year sentences while being innocent.
So Teodora's friend, the woman that she got to know in prison, was this domestic worker named Mayra Figueroa. She was also in prison after a pregnancy that did not go full term. She says she was raped by her employer's nephew while at work. And after she had contractions one day on the job, her employers took her to the hospital. The baby apparently did not survive. And then someone reported her to the police saying she'd tried to abort her baby. Here's Mayra.
I was in the hospital with handcuffs, and a man said to me, "You are so-and-so?" I said, "Yes." "You are being detained because you killed your son." "What?" I responded.
Teodora's story is pretty similar.
I was walking back to the school with a person who was going to help me, and some people said to me, "What we found in the bathroom, who does it belong to?" "It is mine," I said. "My baby had to be born here." "No, you kill it," they said to me. "You kill it." I took out the phone to show them I had called 911, and they arrested me anyways and told me they were going to interrogate me and that I will be sentenced to 30 to 55 years in prison.
Honestly, these stories are all similar. On this past trip, in addition to meeting with Mayra and Teodora, I actually was able to get into the prison and do some interviews. And I met 10 of the 23 women who are still in prison in El Salvador for these crimes. And all of them are marked by the same basic facts. They experience late-term pregnancy losses. Typically, they arrive for emergency care in a hospital, where the healthcare providers, the police, and then later the prosecutors and the judges begin to suspect that because of their deep poverty, they must not have wanted to have these babies.
How do you see this apparent rush to imprison women who miscarry connected to the total ban on abortions in El Salvador?
So at first blush, it really seems irrelevant. I mean, these women didn't have abortions. They didn't want to lose their pregnancies. But when a woman arrives having lost a later pregnancy, then you've got some evidence that there was a pregnancy, that there is a dead baby or a dead fetus. And that suspicion gets taken up by the authorities. And in cases of extreme poverty, everything goes sideways. You don't get decent legal representation. The stories that people are willing to believe because it's a life that is so distinct from theirs, the stories in the media, the stories in the courtroom, the stories even among the guards in the prison are stories of monsters that did something deliberately to kill their babies. Mm.
This might seem pretty distant for many of our listeners here. Is there a connection between Teodora and Myra's cases relevant to the debate we're having now in the U.S. about reproductive rights?
The link between the cases like Myra's and Teodora's and what would happen in this country comes out of poverty. It comes out of the ways in which those in power judge or misunderstand and then judge those without power. And we actually see this pattern here already. We see it in cases that involve overwhelmingly poor women of color who are suspected of taking drugs and harming their fetuses. And they come to the attention of police through misunderstanding of either legal duties to report or misunderstandings of the woman's motivations. And so what you get are these cases where the woman's vulnerability, her poverty, her race, her lack of education gets used, her rape in some cases, gets used as evidence for motive for why she must have actually done something to end her pregnancy. And then weak lawyers. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Could you really imagine something like that happening in the U.S., though? Because, I mean, the criminal justice system in El Salvador, it's much weaker than the one here.
Look, I have a friend, a lawyer like me, who delivered her second child on the toilet in Chicago. Wow. She didn't intend to do so. It came quickly. She mistook the signs of labor. The baby survived because when she called the EMT dispatcher walked her through what she was supposed to do. Nobody accused her of foul play. I know a bunch of stories like that that involve poor women of color in this country that don't end happily.
Different
like
outcomes.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's get back to Teodora and Myra. They protected one another when they were in prison before they were freed. Why was that necessary?
Women accused of having killed their children are the bottom of pecking orders the world over. In El Salvador, the women are subjected to beatings. Teodora had to be in isolation the first 3 months in prison to protect her. When they walk across the yard, people shout at them, "Te comiste a tus hijos," you ate your children. Wow. So the thing that they did once they realized that they were all in for the same crime is that the 17 of them, there were 17 at that point, bonded together to protect one another, and they were able to stop the beatings.
Here's Teodora commenting on that.
We became family in there, not blood relation, but something even closer. We knew we could count on one another.
And Michelle, I know also both women are very concerned about the other women still in prison for what they say are miscarriages. Teodora and Myra have not forgotten about the women they've left behind. Here's Myra.
At least people could help us so the other women can get out. Maybe they can support us because since we got freed, the other ones could too.
Michelle Oberman, what are Teodora and Myra's lives like today and how do they continue their friendship?
They're really quite different from one another. It's not a friendship the way that it might manifest in your ordinary lives. It's more like they're survivors. It reminds me a bit of meeting Holocaust survivors. Like one might laugh so hard that there's tears in their eyes while the other sort of always has that faraway look, you know? I just think we can't imagine what it is that they've endured and that they find deep comfort in one another because they actually can.
Michelle Oberman is the author of Her Body, Our Laws on the Front Lines of the Abortion War from El Salvador to Oklahoma. Michelle, thanks very much for telling us the stories of Teodora and Myra. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. We have an update now on the story of a Syrian refugee who saved the lives of many people during a hazardous boat crossing from Turkey to the Greek island of Lesbos. Sara Mardini was hailed as a hero then. More recently, though, she's run into legal trouble in Greece. My BBC colleague Richard Galpin has her story.
Okay, women and children first. Try to keep the children as dry as you possibly can.
Back in 2015, thousands of refugees and migrants were arriving here on Lesbos every week from nearby Turkey. Amongst those trying to make the journey on flimsy boats were Sara Mardini, 20 years old at the time, and her sister Yusra, who was 17. They were fleeing the Syrian civil war. When the engine on their overcrowded boat failed and it started taking on water, they joined several men who dived into the sea to keep it afloat and had started pulling it towards Lesbos. The sisters were elite swimmers from the Syrian national team. Sara remembers that day as an epic 3.5-hour struggle.
We've been covered with bruises everywhere because there was a sea that was very rough. So while you're holding the boat, there was a lot of wind and water that comes and make your face hit with a dinghy.
But you thought you would make it, you were confident, you didn't think
yes.
This wasn't going to work.
Yes, I was looking to everybody and seeing that we might die. And I knew if I want to make it, I'm going to make it.
Everyone survived and Sara and Yusra received awards in Berlin, which had become their new home. Later, Yusra went on to compete in the Rio Olympics. But in August this year, everything changed when Sara was arrested and put in prison in Athens pending trial. She'd gone to Lesbos as a volunteer for an NGO, helping the refugees and migrants still arriving on the island. She and several colleagues faced serious charges, including being part of a criminal network, people smuggling and spying, which could carry long prison sentences. They strongly deny the charges. Now released on bail and back in Berlin, I asked Sara if she feared she'd never get out of prison.
Yes. I think this is the whole time. Every time I put my head on my pillow, I think about the outside, I think about everybody. And yeah, I say this, would I be able to see them again?
It must be very hard.
Yes. It's just, you know, the whole day you just try to keep yourself busy with things and friends. But the moment when the light is off and you're on your pillow and everybody's asleep, it's like a whole universe is running in my brain. The night was my worst friend.
Sara is slowly trying to readjust after more than 100 days in prison, spending time with friends here at Bard College Berlin, where she'd been studying before her arrest. Although free for now, she still faces the prospect of a trial unless the charges are dropped. She's trying to be optimistic.
I wasn't scared, actually, because I knew what I've done and what have my team done. That's what was totally legal.
Her lawyers describe the charges as baseless, and human rights activists believe it's part of a general crackdown on NGOs in Europe which try to rescue refugees and migrants and provide other help. Kondilia Gugu is Amnesty International's Greece researcher.
I can see a pattern there where we have criminalization of search and rescue.
And that you're saying that's not just in Greece,
no.
It's in other countries?
It's in other countries too. But I've monitored so far 3, 4, 5 cases in Greece where volunteers or members of NGOs face completely absurd charges which can ruin their life because they're trying to assist and do their job. It's definitely a very worrying trend.
Sara Mardini and the others who've been charged can now only wait to see if they will be put on trial.
The BBC's Richard Galpin reporting there. Picture this, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry gyrating to Bhangra beats. The former senators and secretary of state were among the esteemed guests at the wedding of India's richest daughter. If you saw the movie Crazy Rich Asians, think of this as Crazy Rich Indians. The guest list was a who's who among Bollywood's biggest celebrity guests. Shavi Sachdev is a reporter based in Mumbai, and today she has a new title, our Indian wedding expert. Shavi, when two children of two Indian billionaires get married, what happens?
You get the most over-the-top wedding on earth. Isha Ambani is the daughter of India's richest man. His net worth is supposed to be $47 billion, and that's a conservative estimate. His conglomerate has power supply companies, they have mobile network companies, they do fashion retail, they do everything. And the groom, Anand, is the son of other industrialists. They are not quite as wealthy. His father's net worth is a little less. His own net worth is about $4.6 billion.
Give us a sense of the extravagance of this wedding. What's been going on?
Right. So they've had three locations. They had the engagement in Lake Como. And for the pre-wedding ceremonies, they actually took over this picturesque town in Rajasthan in India called Udaipur, also known as the Venice of the East. And then they moved to Mumbai, where Mr. Ambani owns a 27-story apartment. The outside looks like a wedding set, and that's where the actual wedding happened. It is over the top. It is like a big Bollywood movie happening in real life.
I understand Beyonce gave a private performance.
Yes, she did. And the rest of India is kind of upset. They'd like to actually be able to see her in concert, but it was only for a few eyes and ears.
The wedding, of course, took place. The actual wedding was yesterday. But I read that the wedding festivities started back in September. I mean, that's 3 months ago. What's been going on since then?
Yeah, we don't want to do a wedding in just one afternoon. What's the fun of that? You have to celebrate for months. So you start with the engagement, which is not simply, you know, somebody getting down on bended knee and saying, will you marry me? There's a lot of stuff that goes on. It needs days and a huge number of witnesses. So that happened in Italy. And then you have to celebrate that you're getting married. So that was 3 days. And then you get married, which is a bunch of different rituals that take a day or two.
What would a typical wedding be like?
So weddings in India are traditionally arranged, and sometimes the bride and groom don't know each other and the families don't know each other. So they have taken place over a few days so that the families get to know each other, and people have traveled long distances. So you can't just go to, you know, the church and sit for 3 hours and then go home when you've traveled for 4 days.
Is there any sense that this union, this bride and groom from India's richest families, is in some ways arranged?
Oh, Carol, definitely. I'm looking at news clips and these really PR-y pieces about how they've been childhood friends and then they fell in love. That's a very convenient love story. There must have been some amount of encouragement.
Chavi Sachdev is a reporter based in Mumbai. Thanks a lot, Chavi.
My pleasure.
That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI. Public Radio International.